for everybody coming to our final CREPA seminar of the semester. We have a preliminary version of the spring semester calendar in the back, and also you can look at our website for updates. Even though this is the last of our regular Thursday seminar series, there still are a number of events in December that are also posted on the CREPA website. And the series for next semester will start up at the second week of the semester, January 31st, 2013. I just want to bring your attention to some upcoming events for this next week. One is tomorrow, the UW-Madison Russian.
Tomorrow or Saturday?
Oh yes, I'm ahead of myself. Saturday. We still have another day this week. Saturday, December 8th, the UW-Madison Russian Folk Orchestra concert is going to take place at the Grace Episcopal Church, Madison. It's free, and that orchestra is headed by our own Victor Gardinsky from the library, so I really recommend that event. Just talking to Jennifer also about the holiday craft fair for Russia-related items. This is the Russian Educational Association also this weekend. And for some more serious, after that sort of lighthearted stuff, a more serious event is next Tuesday, a film called What Can Dead Prisoners Do, which is about Soviet prisoners of war in Poland. It's at 7 o'clock next Tuesday at the Marquee Theater in Union South. Very nice space. Winston Chu, an assistant professor of modern Central European history at UW-Milwaukee, will be introducing the film and moderating the post-film discussion. It's sponsored by CREKA, WUD Film, Polish Heritage Club of Madison, the UW-Madison Polish Students Association, as well as the Consulate General of the Republic of Poland in Chicago. So I recommend it's probably going to be an interesting film and interesting discussion. Last but not least, we have our seminar for today. I feel like this is kind of like it's like an old style TV show where you have to give it advertisements before the main event. Anyways.
So cool.
Yeah. And have some snacks. Some refreshments if you would like. Okay. Including wine, because following university regulations is after 4 p.m. and we have the required permits. So I introduce you to partake in that. Okay.
If you're over 21.
Yeah, if you're over 21. Okay. Today's speaker is Anna Peretskaya, a sociologist who studies, among other things, political and economic liberalizations that happened in Central Europe and Eurasia in the late 20th century. She received her PhD from the Department of Sociology at the New School of Social Research in New York City. Her work has won several awards from the American Sociological Association, most recently from the Council for European Studies. She teaches classical sociological theory at UW-Madison and is the co-editor of the bilingual English and Russian journal Laboratorium, Russian Review of Social Research. So thank you, Anna, for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you all for coming on the almost last day of the semester. I really appreciate that, and I was trying to keep my talk really short because of that, but actually I'm afraid I might have to take all the 50 minutes that I was allocated, and maybe even more, although I'll try to speak really fast. I've been practicing all semester in my class. So so as you might be aware, yesterday marked a 1-year anniversary of the beginning of the most recent wave of popular protest in Russia. And that wave brought out on the streets the largest numbers of people in years and maybe even decades. And it also lasted quite long, lasted for at least 3 months, depending on how you count. So for those who don't close Russian politics, those who don't follow Russian politics very closely or very on a regular basis, I'll try to give a brief timeline of the protests. So everything started on Sunday, December 4th, 2011, when Russian citizens voted in a parliamentary election. And in the end of that evening, the pro-Putin party, Yedinaya Rossiya, United Russian, was pronounced the winner and ended up with almost 53% of the seats in the parliament. But despite its apparent victory, the party had much weaker performance than before. It received 15% fewer votes, and therefore 77 fewer seats in the parliament than in the previous election cycle 4 years earlier. However, by next morning, Russian internet was awash with reports from hundreds, if not thousands, of independent observers who had witnessed electoral fraud of all kinds, starting with just pure stuffing of ballot boxes to forging final tallies in some election wards. And very often, more often than not, these reports were followed by photographs or even video recordings. And the best known image supporting that the claim that the fraud actually took place was a shot of a television screen, and that was an official program, I believe, an official television channel, showing that results of results in one of the Russian regions added up to 146%. So the next day, because of that, and it was December 5th, between 5 and 8,000 people showed up after work in the center of Moscow to protest this electoral fraud. And it was 5 and maybe even 10 times more people than the organizers of this rally hoped for. But to that date, it was the biggest rally again in years. And two main leaders of the event, along with dozens of other activists, ended up sentenced for 15 days behind bars for disorderly conduct because they, or something like that, I don't remember exactly, but something quite minor, because after the rally, they tried marching toward the headquarters of the Central Electoral Commission, which was only about a mile down the street. And for the next couple of days, there was also a lot of street activity in Moscow and other Russian cities that also included actually pro-Putin supporters. But over 1,000 of opposition activists were detained by the police over those few days for, again, sort of disorderly conduct or congregating without permit or something like that. And by Friday that week, about 30,000 people on Facebook and another 18,000 people on the Russian equivalent of Facebook, the social network ВКонтакте, declared that they'd be coming out to a rally that was being organized for December 10th in Moscow. So altogether, almost 50,000 people. Again, this seemed like a huge number to the organizers. And despite the disagreements within this ad hoc committee of organizers regarding the venue for the event, which according to Russian law had to be approved by Moscow authorities, and also disagreements about the list of speakers, I'll talk about it a little later, the rally took place just outside of Moscow, Kremlin, and was attended by anywhere between 25,000 and 80,000 people. And I'm going to be giving this hugely ranging numbers because there is clearly no, the police count down and the organizers count up, of course. So even more people, up to 100,000, came out 2 weeks later on December 24th. And the demands at both rallies were to investigate electoral fraud, repeat the vote in a truly free and fair manner, free all political prisoners, including those who were nabbed in the days after the election, and to pass legislation that would allow more parties to run for parliament. After a six-week break for the holidays and for strategizing, another huge crowd turned out, and that was in the range of 36,000 to 120,000 people. Turned out to march for about 1 mile in Moscow in a 4-degree cold weather, 4 degree Fahrenheit. That was on February 4th, exactly a month before the scheduled presidential election. And in another 3 weeks, some 20 to 30,000 Moscovites participated in a flash mob action called the Big White Ring, when they stood shoulder to shoulder, holding hands, and wearing white ribbons and other white accessories, and wanted to show actually that there were enough of them that they could encircle the Kremlin, and they managed that. And that's where the photograph comes from for the flyer for this event. On March 4th, then Prime Minister Putin was again elected president, and he, as you might remember, he was president between 2000 and 2008 for two terms, and then had to take a break because of the way the law is written. His victory was both anticipated and unexpected by the protesters and everyone else, because on the one hand, there weren't really any strong candidates to oppose him. Even the new to politics and therefore positioning himself as uncorrupt and independent oligarch Mikhail Prokhorov did not really command an unambiguous support of the protesters. On the other hand, people who opposed Putin were hoping that he wouldn't get the majority of votes in the first round, and then there would be a runoff election. The general consensus among the public and independent scholars was that the voting irregularities did take place, but they were of a different kind than in the parliamentary election, and they were not as brazen and therefore not as easy to detect and document, and they were also actually not enough of them to very significantly influence the outcome of the election. Moscow was the only region where Putin didn't get the majority of votes, and that also was the region where with highest number of independent electoral observers, and scholars tie these or connect this to phenomena. The presidential election was followed by two protest rallies on March 5th and 10th, but they were attended by many fewer participants, 30 to 50,000 people, according to most optimistic counts, and their goals and demands were much less clear, and the rallies were much less cheerful than before. The next big protest came on June 6th, the day before Putin's inauguration, and this was the first rally of March that turned somewhat violent. There were several clashes between protesters and the police. And the march was truncated and broken up, but it gave birth and sort of never reached its final destination, but it also gave birth to the equivalent of the Moscow version of the Occupy movement, which set up camp that lasted for about 3 weeks, and every day in that camp there were thousands of people participating in all sorts of events. But the police dispersed that camp, as I said, about 3 weeks later. And the last mass rally took place on June 12th, Russia's Independence Day, with probably about 20 to 30 people in attendance in Moscow, 10,000 in St. Petersburg, and smaller crowds in a few other cities. So over the past few days, if you've been reading Russian media, in the run-up to this first year anniversary of the protests, you could see that the media, both sort of more official media and social networks, were flooded with what can be described as obituaries for the protest movement. The bottom line of much commentary, although of course not all of it, but much of it was that the results of the parliamentary election of last year were standing, Putin is president, there are more political prisoners now than there were before, the opposition is divided, people are demoralized, in short, nothing changed since then, and the activist drive of the past year has been wasted completely. So that's sort of a sentiment very popular right now, but again, I want to say that it's not everyone feels that way. And some of it is clearly true. The party of power is still at the helm, but I, at the same time, with a few people who oppose that view, I'd like to offer a little more optimistic version of the consequences of the protest movement. So someone whose teenage years coincided with Perestroika in the Soviet Union, I watched my family get interested, all of a sudden get interested in politics, start talking about debating political merits of different political policies, you know, over dinner, going to rallies, etc. And I've always, as a sociologist, I've always wanted to understand why people, like my parents, get interested in politics, what motivates them and their participation, how this interest and this participation translate or don't translate very often into democratic politics, and what actually democratic politics is in the first place. Because of the strong emphasis on theory in the graduate program that I went to, I find it useful and interesting to think about my research questions in terms of theories of sociological classics, people like Karl Marx, Emil Durkheim, Max Weber, and of course, Alexis de Tocqueville. I'm not the only one doing so, I'm often glad to discover. In the past couple of years, at least two edited volumes engaging with Tocqueville came out. One was titled Conversations with Tocqueville, The Global Democratic Revolution in the 21st Century, and the other one was Anxieties of Democracy, Tocquevillian Reflections on India and the United States. And Tocqueville is not the only classical sociological theorist who is still sort of around. Just the other day, I came across an article, very recent article by a historian, that was titled Max Weber in the Provinces, Measuring Imperial Russia by Modern Standards. So classical, I'm glad to see, as a teacher of classical sociology, I'm glad to see that it is still with us. Before I move on, actually, with my talk, even though I'm already 15 minutes into, I want to sort of, I have a couple of caveats. First, because I do watch Russian politics quite closely, and I do try to stay up, stay current on relevant scholarship, I haven't, the actual research that I've done is very limited on this particular project, and therefore my talk is going to be sort of impressionistic and more along the lines of food for thought, based on reports from the media and my observations of social networking sites, blogs, etc., rather than sort of like a report on a complete research project. Also, because many of my sources are Moscow-centric, most of my talk focuses on Moscow, what was going on in Moscow. But I would like to stress that there was very similar activity in other Russian cities, although, again, mostly in large cities, of course. There is very little reason to think that the motivations behind this activity and meaning what they meant to the people who participated in them would be much different. So, as you probably know, Alexis de Tocqueville was a 19th century French aristocrat and social theorist, and his most famous books are Democracy in America, two volumes of which were published in 1835 and 1840 respectively, and The Old Regime and the French Revolution, published in 1856. The latter, actually, I read just recently, was very popular in Russia at the time the book was published, and it was probably because it coincided, the publication coincided with the ascent to the throne of the Russian Tsar Alexander II, who soon after becoming the Tsar started a series of reforms that, as you might know, culminated in the abolition of serfdom in 1861. But interestingly, most Russian politicians took Tocqueville's The Old Regime and the French Revolution as a caution against any reforms because of what is now known as the Tocqueville paradox, and I know it came up in the talk here last week. And basically, rather than making people content, reforms and improvements lead to increased discontent and dissatisfaction. And people revolt when things get better and not worse. That's the essence of this Tocqueville's paradox. But that was concern, obviously, for the Russian authorities back then, but it seems that Alexander II was able to convince, to persuade the skeptics and still go through with the reforms. But that's not what my talk is about, of course. So Tocqueville himself never made it to Russia, as far as I know, but he certainly knew enough about the country because he famously, and quite pessimistically, I would suggest, ended his the first volume of Democracy in America with a juxtaposition of America and Russia, anticipating the rivalry of these two countries, between these two countries in the 20th and 21st century. And so that's what he wrote about it. There are today two great peoples on Earth who, though they started from different points, seem to be advancing toward the same goal, the Russians and the Anglo-Americans. Both grew in obscurity, and while humanity's gaze was focused elsewhere, they abruptly vaulted to the first rank among nations. The world learned almost simultaneously of their birth and their grandeur. But of course, there were also, he noted, about important differences between these two countries. The American does battle with the obstacles that nature has placed before him. The Russian grapples with men. One combats wilderness and barbarity, the other civilization with all its arms. To achieve his goal, the American relies on personal interests and allows individuals to exercise their strength and reason without guidance. The Russian, in a sense, concentrates all the power of society in one man. The American's principal means of action is liberty. The American's principal means of action is liberty. The Russian's servitude. The points of departure are different. The ways diverse. Yet each seems called by a secret design of providence someday to sway the destinies of half the globe. So, and for much of this rivalry that did happen, and Tocqueville sort of predicted, Russia remained in servitude of one kind or another. But the question is it still now, 180 years, almost 200 years after Tocqueville's diagnosis, is it still in servitude? And I believe that even though Tocqueville usually was not an enthusiastic supporter of popular uprisings, of mass actions on the streets, he would have seen this most recent Russian protest movement as a step toward democratic liberty, rather than a sign of anarchy. And before I explain why I think so and give my examples, I would like to look a little closer to an important element of Tocqueville's theory of democratic liberty. And that's what, I'm sorry, has very little to do with Russia, but that's sort of, I think it's important to have this understanding. First of all, democracy to Tocqueville means not how the polity is governed, but who constitutes it. And in democratic societies, as opposed to aristocracies, for example, and Tocqueville was, by the way, a big fan of aristocracies, democratic societies are those where political rights and duties of individuals are equally distributed, and where no one was born with privilege of legislative authority. Democracy, as Tocqueville conceptualizes it, as a quality of condition and the absence of aristocracy as the guardians of liberty, and that's why he was a fan of aristocracy. Democracy has several inherent dangers, and the most acute of which is the individualistic economic interest. Individualism, which Tocqueville differentiated from just pure egoism, is a product of the equality of condition. And in aristocracy, he believed people were bound to each other by the tradition of duty and patronage, duty to each other and patronage among them. But the new democratic condition, he wrote, disposes each member of the community to sever himself from the mass of his fellow creatures and to draw apart with his family and with his friends, so that after he has thus formed a little circle of his own, he willingly leaves society at large to itself. The woof of time is evenly is every instant broken, and the track of generations is effaced. Those who went before are soon forgotten. Of those who will soon come after, no one has any idea. The interest of men is confined to those in close propinquity to himself. So there is no understanding of past connection with past, future, or sort of with people around you. It's withdrawal from the society, basically. And equality of condition also fosters love of material well-being, and thus intense focus on economic success. When no one is born into privilege that legally cannot be overcome, no one can be expected, and no one can be ordered to be satisfied with less than any fellow citizen has. And so that is why this drive for economic success and such a focus on economic activity. And that's what Tocqueville says. In their intense and exclusive anxiety to make a fortune, they lose sight of the close connection that exists between the private fortune of each and the prosperity of all. The better to look after what they call their own business, they neglect their chief business, which is to remain their own masters. The excessive taste they conceive of these material enjoyment makes them surrender to the first master who appears. And the main consequence of this pursuit of economic interest is abdication of citizens' political power and the rise of the centralized state administration of tutelage or guardianship, in other words, of this new democratic despotism, as Tocqueville calls it. It is his other notion that deals with how of governing, not who, but how, and the ability of a political community to practice republican self-government is designated by him as liberty. And the opposite of liberty is tyranny or despotism or servitude, the word that he used to describe Russia, for example. And both are marked by the centralization of government and power in the hands of either aristocracy or monarchy or any other autocrat. You know, Russia is not an aristocratic, but nonetheless can be construed as an autocratic country. And tyranny and despotism are synonymous with the negation of the capacity for such self-government. So Tocqueville posits that three sets of factors contribute to and therefore explain the stability of American democratic republic, and that's what he sort of writes about in Democracy in America. First set of factors are geographic, economic, and military circumstances of the country. The country is big enough and rich, and you don't need to fight anyone for it. He sort of brackets the Native Americans. Second is the laws and institutions, such as vertical and horizontal divisions of power. And the third one are the subjective dispositions of Americans, or habits of the heart, as he calls them. In other words, customs and norms and practices of the people. And so it was not only the design of the American political system, the constitutional separation of powers, that prevented tyranny's rise, but more so the whole moral and intellectual condition of the American people, as he puts it. In other words, democratic institutions were present alongside a pre-existing and more decisively important democratic culture. But what is this peculiar American culture of freedom, and where does it come from? The most important practice that Tocqueville points is the Americans' drive to constantly form associations in order to make themselves useful to their fellow creatures. But also the understanding that collective self-help serves their own interest, or the term that he uses to describe it also is self-interest rightly understood. In short, it is the civic mindedness or realization of being part of a society and sharing interests with fellow citizens that propel Americans to participate voluntarily in self-government, or as we would call it now, in civil society. And in American culture, in America, this culture to a large extent is a product of the Protestant Christianity that the Puritans brought with them, established with the or that existed with the establishment of the American state. But once firmly established, these religious, secular, and political groups and organizations perpetuate this culture of civility and civic spirit. So you don't really need religion anymore for these practices and culture to go on. But in Europe, and presumably elsewhere, on the other hand, the people have to be educated to the practice of freedom, and the reform of custom itself a political task that can take many years and maybe even decades. So conditions of existence of democracy and liberty are the main subjects of both of his books. For example, the driving force behind his Democracy in America is to understand how it is that in America, an order based on equal human freedom leads to prosperity and stability, while in Europe, and in France more in particular, even the first steps on the road to such an order and in war, civil war, continual instability, reactionary regression, and constant fear of revolutionary uprising by the popular masses. America is democratic, free, and stable, while post-aristocratic France of Tocqueville oscillates between despotism and anarchy, or at least that's the fear. And one reason I think that Tocqueville's work is very useful in understanding Russia in particular, and Russia of the post-Soviet period, Russian politics, post-Soviet politics, is that both in the political and in popular discourses, this tutelary despotism and anarchy, or strong hand, or is it strong arm, I forget, and stability versus chaos, to use the terms that you know they would use in Russia, are presented as the only two alternatives. So this means that the opposite of tutelage and guardianship is often equated with disorder rather than stability and liberty of the U.S. style. And this way of thinking was very obvious at the beginning of the last year protests in Russia, both on the part of the regime, but also the protesters. The authorities often tried to draw parallels between Russian protests and the uprisings of the Arab Spring, and in particular the one in Libya that ended up the worst, so to say, at least for the deposed leader, while the protesters were very consciously distancing themselves from the events of the Arab Spring and saying that it was very different in Russia. No to revolution, yes to the constitution. This was a comment on the Facebook page of one of the groups organizing the protest, but it sums up this sentiment the best, I think, in most succinct way. Not only do we know that the protests were, with one exception, very, very peaceful, and thus did not result in the eruption of the mythical Ruskiy Bunt, Russian Revolt, I'd like to suggest that the protest activity of the last year and the and other associated with these events and activities were actually manifestations of the development, at long last, of the culture of democratic liberty that, according to Tocqueville, is imperative for stability of liberal democratic democratic polities. And let me finally get to my illustrations of this point. The biggest change that seemed to have happened and to which the protest activity testified was the ebbing of focus on purely personal and materialistic pursuits, or of economic individualism, that, to use Tocqueville's term. As one of the participants articulated, that lack of interest in politics, a politicianist, has ceased to be grounds for pride. Another one confirmed, people at last have come to realize that in order for anything to be right, they need to step up themselves rather than just sit around and wait. Only 10 years ago, volunteering and charity were, if not unheard of, then very suspicious modes of activity in Russia, and because it was hard to believe that there was no self-serving ulterior motive behind these activities. But the protests became a real triumph of voluntary and uncompensated activity. First of all, there were, even before the protests, there were thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people all across the country serving as, volunteering as electoral observers. And that involved several hours of training before the voting day, and then they required them to spend the entire day, and in some cases, parts of the night or entire night, in usually uninviting and dreary polling stations, engaged in pretty tedious and glamorous work of keeping a watchful eye at often unscrupulous electoral officials. And so these people wanted to see for themselves that the elections were going to be as fair as officials were promising, and to do all that they could to ensure they were, if the system was indeed rigged as opposition politicians were claiming. It was these volunteers who exposed the scope of electoral fraud, and they were among the ones who, among the early and enthusiastic participants of the first post-electoral rallies. And as one political observer wrote, it is these people who know the real price of these elections, it is them who make the idea of fair election a material force that sooner or later will prevail. Then the protests themselves required a lot of volunteers, not only the organizing committee, which included professional opposition politicians, but also journalists and writers and other cultural workers. And the participants as well, sort of many of them spent a lot of time preparing for the protest by making handmade, creative, and very witty, often very witty, and sometimes very elaborate signs. Protest signs. And besides, already at the second massive rally in the end of December, there was a good number of volunteer marshals who handed out flyers and white ribbons and other insignia, who collected trash, and they counted the protesters and signed up electoral observers and did all that work that goes into organizing. And it is important to remember that no single organization, like a political party or a trade union, or even a group of such organizations, was really responsible for mobilization of all these people who came to all these rallies. Only about 10% of participants said that they belonged to a political organization of any kind. And like most attendees of these rallies, the marshals too self-organized using internet communities and social media. And if one would one word to add up all the time that all these people spent on all these activities, it would come up to millions and maybe even tens of millions of man hours. And taking into account that they all had fairly high qualifications as professionals, it would be equivalent to billions of rubles, summarized one popular Russian magazine. Then, of course, there was an issue of financing this rally, speaking of money, the sound system, the stage, porta potties, and over the 3 months of December through March, organizers collected 9 million rubles, which is about $300,000, and mostly through small donations of $5 to $10. And again, this is I think this is a testimony that many Russian citizens, at least those who donated it, they the money and their time as well, they reject the social contract of the early 21st century, which rested on the authorities granting their subjects personal freedoms to make money or for self-expression in exchange for their non-interference in political realm. And to use Tocqueville's words here, no longer the discharge of political duties appears to them to be troublesome impediment which diverts them from their occupation and business, and they now understand the connection between their private fortunes of each and the prosperity of all. So this would be Tocquevillian analysis of this particular aspect. Next is the fact that not only Russian voters in mass spontaneously participated in these rallies, both by being there and also by donating their time and money, they were no longer afraid or shy to express their protest publicly and collectively. And for older Russians, even of my age, expressing political views or showing membership in a civic organization by wearing that organization's colors or buttons or some other insignia might be even more difficult than joining that organization. It is undoubtedly a reaction formation to the over-dominant collectivism of the Soviet days, with its red scarves and, you know, Lenin lapel pins and special uniforms for school children, holiday uniforms, and so on. And so even in the old days, people wanted to stand out, and when those Soviet organizations and symbols disappeared, not many were eager to have them replaced. And collectivism was at least seemingly rejected for the sake of capitalist individualism. But in the wake of the last year parliamentary elections, the sentiment has changed, at least for hundreds of thousands of people who almost immediately adopted the new symbol of the movement for the fair election, the white ribbon, which many wore not only to the rallies, but also on a daily basis, and also adorned their social media avatars with it. Until recently, such public expression of membership was taken as a sign of groupthink and expected mostly from staunch political activists and often of a radical stripe, either socialist or communist or nationalist on the other hand. For many, it was not easy to join the protests, to be in the crowd, as they often admitted in interviews. But once this discomfort was overcome, many rally participants gleefully commented on the sense of solidarity and community that they felt at protests. They didn't find themselves to be a part of a mob, as they feared, but rather of a benevolent public, members of which smiled to each other and gifted each other, and also policemen who tried to control them, with all these symbols of for the protests. One for all and all for one. That was one of the signs at an early protest, and now it have become for many Russians not only a reference to a cult Soviet version of the of Three Musketeers, but also a profoundly felt sentiment that many of the participants described in the interviews with media and sociologists. It was probably most evocatively illustrated by a participant of the most spontaneous of those actions, the Big White Ring flash mob in late February. She wrote, "This is an unforgettable feeling. We're standing on the sidewalk shoulder to shoulder, and all the cars on the road are honking, and people in them are shouting to us, 'We're with you.' They waved white ribbons at us, not only from cars, but from trolley buses too. And from cars without any white symbols, they nonetheless shouted, 'We're with you.'" So, you know, this is sort of a feeling of solidarity is very unusual to both have it, to express it, and to appreciate it. This This is very similar to what Tocqueville described as the habit of considering this is a sign of disappearance of what Tocqueville described as a habit of considering themselves as standing alone. People in Russia no longer, or some at least of them, no longer have this habit of considering themselves of standing alone. And general indifference is not a public virtue any longer. So in the same self-conscious way that both the organizers and participants of these protests underscored and enforced the movement's peaceful and self-limiting character, they, for the most part, remained nonpartisan and united. And this is also very unusual for Russian oppositional politics. Already at the first rally, one of the activists, Alexei Navalny, called for unity when he wrote in his blog, "It does not matter who's organizing the rally. Everyone has to come out to protest. Nationalists, liberals, leftists, green, vegetarians, Martians. Everyone had their vote stolen." And at the same time, when the activists were calling for unity, Russian internet communities began to independently process, discuss, and plan scenarios for peaceful expression of civic position, also framing it not in terms of political opposition, but of a common cause. And another protest sign that shows this sentiment was, "We are not the opposition, we are the people." As I mentioned before, after the first still small rally, some of the most visible activists got detained, and the task of negotiating with authorities and therefore planning or organizing the rallies fell into the hands of a group that was considered less partisan and often non-professional opposition figures who were not necessarily themselves didn't necessarily have any ideological agenda. And this is not to say that organizing committee didn't have any disagreements or squabbles, but for once, political leaders and activists of various stripes were trying to put their agendas, their own agendas or agendas of their own political groups aside, as they realized that even if they were on the stage addressing the rally, the people who they spoke to, who they addressed, did not come to that rally to support them personally, but they came there to support a common cause. And most of the political activists speaking at this rallies did not command much authority over the protesters, as sociologists found out. It was mostly members of the, the artistic intelligentsia, who among the organizers and the speakers, who garnered most support and respect of the protesters. And to give an example some of the squabbles were overcome, organizing of these protests, especially in the first days, was marked by debate whether to include Russian nationalist groups, even the moderate nationalists, in the planning of the rallies and to give their representatives a chance to speak. There were a lot of skeptics and opponents of doing this, but the majority in the end chose to compromise and to include nationalists. No doubt it was done to preserve the image of the movement as a non-ideological or even beyond ideology, and to demonstrate that demands of fair elections is something that groups of all different stripes and all from all political ends of political spectrum can agree on. A small splinter group unhappy with such an alliance with the nationalists attempted to organize an alternative rally on February 4th, but no more than 200 people showed up to it, while close to 100,000 marched elsewhere in Moscow alongside those nationalist groups. And actually, organizers of that march agreed on marching in formations that were organized according to political ideologies, liberals, nationalists, and socialists. However, at the head of the march, there was a so-called civic alliance, and everyone, even members of those other political movements, were welcome to march there. And explaining this decision, moderators of one of the protest mobilization hubs on Facebook wrote that such format of the march was actually good for preserving unity and tolerance. First, they said putting the civic alliance at the head of the march prevented radicals of any stripe from taking the lead at the rally. Secondly, the division by political ideology would demonstrate that the overwhelming majority of the participants, they put the number on it, 97%, not only did not belong to any political organization, but also did not share any of the political ideologies of this other movement, so that the majority were ideological, at least at the moment. And lastly, the moderators reminded that one of the goals of the march, and by extension of the entire protest movement, was to ensure that, and I quote, the widest possible spectrum of political forces in the new Russia was present, and to guarantee that the relationship among these parties were based on competition, but also on mutual respect. We're all practicing mutual tolerance, even if we don't like each other, they said. And the moderators of this Facebook group were right. While in the beginning of the march, the political groups tried to maintain some division amongst themselves, in the end, when they arrived to their destination, they all mixed in together into one big crowd. First of all, to keep each other warm, because that was the coldest day of the year, or at least for the protests. And they also unanimously voted for the rally's demands to fair election, regardless of their otherwise political differences. And the protests have proved that such dialogue across political divisions is not only desirable, but possible in Russia, which many people actually, until recently, doubted and still remain skeptical about. But there is a growing understanding of the absolute need to avoid violent action and of the need to stay together to jointly press the authorities to open a meaningful dialogue, a recent analysis concluded. And of course, leaders of different political groups that participated in these rallies have admitted, and their constituents understood this perfectly well and understand it now, that one day they would fiercely compete against each other in a free and fair election, but for now they were supporting each other and putting their ideological differences aside to ensure such an election actually happened. As Tocqueville put it, the desire of being elected leads all men in the long run to support each other, and if it happens that an election accidentally severs two friends, the electoral system brings a multitude of citizens permanently together who would otherwise always have remained unknown to each other. And this brings me to my last point, and I thank you for your patience. While the mass street protests are over, demands for fair election have not stopped. They are just taking different forms now, but the forms that are consistent with the exercise of Tocquevillian customs of democratic liberty. For Tocqueville, it is not only voluntary associations that are, so to say, the schools of democracy, but also the institutions of local self-government. And as if they heard Tocqueville say, town meetings are to liberty what primary schools are to science, they bring it within people's reach. They teach men how to use and how to enjoy it. Quite a few protesters ran in the spring of this year in municipal elections as independent candidates. That was particularly true in Moscow, where there were twice as many candidates than previously. And opposition candidates, either from opposition parties or running as independents, won about one-third of all municipal seats, which is more than three times what they got in 2008 in the previous election cycle. And not only the number of independent and opposition candidates spiked after the protest, but also did the number of people willing to vote for them. And some of these candidates, and now some of them are members of municipal boards, they were local activists of political organizations, but many, especially newcomers to electoral and more generally political processes, and actually I want to make sure that you understand that most people who participated in those marches and rallies, they were complete political novices. So many of these candidates and now members did not belong to any political parties or clubs, and often they ran very low budget and actually low profile campaigns and nonetheless got elected. And these are not very glamorous positions, so because they don't pay much and there is no media attention, and actually what they can do is very, very limited. But many activists do see their local boards and their municipal districts as breeding grounds for change and arenas to mobilize their constituents, actually. And so another election that's worth mentioning here is the election of the opposition's coordinating council, which took place in the end of October, just a month and a half ago. It was unique in several aspects. First, an entirely independent and transparent electoral system was set up for this election. Much of it was coordinated online and was transparent, as I said, to everyone to see. The election was preceded by a two-month-long electoral campaign during which over 200 candidates registered, and this is a 45-member body. These candidates debated each other in several rounds of televised debates, and after each of these debates, the viewers, who were potential registered voters, would rank candidates. Those Russian citizens who wanted to vote in this election had to register and get verified prior to casting their votes, and both of these stages and the election itself required quite a bit of persistence on the part of people who wanted to do that, as they involved several stages, and people had to know how to use computer and cell phone technology, and not every Russian, especially of older generations, is very comfortable with that. But the voting too, which for the most part took place entirely online, was almost sabotaged by cyber attacks, and they actually had to extend it by 24 hours to let people vote. Despite all of these technological obstacles, over 170,000 people registered to be voters, close to 100,000 got verified, and 81,000 voted in the election. And actually more than half of the voters were from the outside of Moscow, and that was one of the, sort of, prior to the election, that was one of the fears that it would be all constrained to Moscow. It would be sort of like the elite activity. And thus it was not a political forum or party congress that elected this coordinating committee of the opposition, but the Russian citizens themselves who chose to participate in the voting and the process, which many of them described as quite cumbersome. So not all political groups that participate in the protest movement chose to run candidates in this election, but one-third of the council was elected on three so-called party lists, and again, those were liberals, nationalists, and leftists, socialists. While the members of the council have often exhibited personal ambition, ideological differences, mutual suspicion, lack of trust, and all sorts of other negative things, they are nonetheless attempting to ensure that the coordination of the opposition's disparate part is taking place, and it is in itself a very big and important development. The council has already met twice, and its sessions are streamed online for, again, everyone to watch. The first joint statement condemned the government's repression and the torture of opposition activists, and the council is now organizing another march for December 15th. And so we'll see what happens there, and how many people turn up, and what are the consequences of those, of this new stage of development. So, of course, the protests that started a year ago were not the first expression of the awakening of civil society. I'm going to use this cliche, although I don't like it very much. But they were the most public and massive, and a surprise to the authorities, to the previously small groups of opposition activists, and to the protesters themselves. This publicity, this open character, and how many of them there were. So this internet hamsters, as they were often referred to before the spike of the protest activity, the discovery of how many they were was in itself an amazing thing, judging by the statements of many of them in the media and on social networks. Before December 2011, 1,000 people at the protest was good news, and now we consider anything below 50,000 a flop, many of them have remarked. Secondly, the protests not only brought discontent of thousands of people out in the open, but specifically and clearly focused this protest movement on the political sphere and the existing political system of hyper-presidentialism, rather than on individual leaders, politicians, or bureaucrats, as was often the case previously. At the same time, these mass street actions articulated a consensus, at least among their participants, that only peaceful change is acceptable, even though it is recognized that it will be very slow. There is an understanding that the processes of building a civil society and bringing about political change are slow and very often very tedious, but there also seems to be willingness to spend time and money on these processes. And there's also a lot of reflection going on about personal transformations as a result of these of participation in these protests, and resolve, although sometimes also mutual and public persuading, to continue participation in public affairs as the primary, if not the only, means to cultivate the democratic mores. The internalization of norms of independence and responsibility among the common people until recently was unnoticed in Russia, is finally taking hold. And this is quite a radicalization of the Russian society. As I said, I want to understand how the political culture changes and where these new customs and habits come from. Tocqueville, in his theory, doesn't give a very firm answer when he compares Russia and, France and the United States. And this is an important weakness in his theory. I think that somehow Russia can help us correct this flaw. I don't have my own answers yet developed very well, and I'm actually, but I want, since I wanna, this is my main interest, I wanna invite you all to share with me your ideas and your hypotheses, and so maybe I can move on with that somewhere. Thank you very much for your patience, and I apologize this was so long.